1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 9 through 10. It's been such a crazy summer. I feel like we've been in just a very small section of 1 Timothy since about April or something. We haven't made a whole lot of progress with all that goes on during the summer, and I guess that's okay. But we'll be looking at verses 9 and 10 tonight. I had intended to go maybe all the way through 16, but that didn't work out. So 9 and 10, we didn't even get close. All right, so what have we been looking at so far? Anybody remember the context of where we're at? We're talking about these widows. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Are they truly widows? There's the big question, right? How do we know if they're truly widows? Well, I mean, there's the obvious test, right? Has their husband passed on? But there's a different issue going on, or a deeper issue going on here in the text. And Paul refers to widows who are truly widows, meaning as far as the church is concerned. Now, let's not think Paul is against widows or anything like that. He's not anti-widows, but he is setting some criteria for the church and how they are to care for certain widows, the true widows, the ones that are truly without anyone else. So, he made some statements, set some criteria in what we looked at a week or two ago, whenever it was. First of all, they have no children or grandchildren to care for them. Paul said they are all alone, all right? If there are children or grandchildren, Paul says they should care for them. And this is not just it's a good idea. It's for the betterment of society. Paul says this is a significant issue. I was trying to think right here. Oh, he said in verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives, especially members of his own household, he has denied the faith. Not just a good idea for the betterment of society. This is a spiritual matter. All right. So no children or grandchildren. He said these true widows have set their hope, has set her hope on God, and she prays night and day. She's a prayer warrior. So that's the first set of criteria that we've seen, and there are more that we'll see later. But let me ask you just a question right off the bat to kind of get us thinking. Why do you think the church needs to make such distinctions? I mean, why can't we just say, look, if the husband's dead, widow, there it is, church ought to care for them. Why do we need to make such distinctions? So the church really can't care for everyone, and it takes a responsibility away from the family that is a God-given responsibility. All right, what else? You think of other reasons? Why should this be a big deal for the church? Why do we need such distinctions between widows? Resources. Yeah, so resources are limited. If the church just says, we'll help anybody and everybody who comes, then you have this possibility where people are like, oh, well, I don't have to care for them anymore. The church will do it. Hey, look at our government and the way it goes. The more they hand out, the more people are like, oh, well, we don't have to do as much for ourselves or for other people, right? So the more other people step in. Now, there are some, just like with our government, there are some who genuinely need help. In the church, there are widows who genuinely need that kind of assistance and care from the church. But as we'll see, there's more to it than that. There's a kind of character that's involved, more criteria that we'll look at. And so we'll look at a few of those this evening. Let me go ahead and read verses 9 through 10. Here's what Paul says. He's talking about true widows here. He says, let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband, having a reputation for good works, if she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work. Anybody here qualified to be a good widow? That's a tough one, isn't it? Right? So we get some additional criteria. We'll deal with the easy one first. Paul says she needs to be at least 60 years old there in verse 9. Now, does that hold to today? In other words, is that just describing the way it was there, or is it prescribing the way it should be today? Well, why does Paul say that they should be 60 years old? Because it was in the culture of that time, that was considered, no offense to those who are 60, but that was considered old age, okay? It was considered old age, and it was the age that is beyond the expectation that someone could or would or would be expected to go out and get married again. Don't look at me like that, all right? Betty's giving me eyes over there, right? But that was just the expectation in that time, the cultural view of old age, all right? So, you know, what would a church do today? Well, if we had such an order or such a criteria, we would have to evaluate that based on our culture. All right, so it needs to be 60 years old. That's probably not the most critical thing for us to look at tonight. So we'll move on from that. Then we come to our old friend there in verse 9, after Paul says they should be not less than 60 years of age. Then he says, having been the wife of one husband. That's what verse 9 says. Oh my. We've dealt with this already in the text, haven't we? Just in reverse, right? The husband of one wife. Where do we stand on this issue? Somebody clarify for me where we stand on this. Or is that putting us on the spot? Yeah, but that's the big question, Asa. What does it say exactly? I'm gonna try to give us some understanding, but I guarantee you that we probably won't 100% agree. They're not polygamous. Yeah, I mean that's one theory out there, right? They don't have multiple wives, but I don't know if there's much evidence that that's really a problem in the church at this time. We have polygamy as a real issue, but definitely it would exclude polygamy. Yes. Now, on this hand, though, let's see. Before it was the husband of one wife. Now it's the wife of one husband. Is polyandry an issue where a woman has multiple husbands? Well, I mean, I guess you could go back to Jesus' encounter with the woman at the well, and what did he say to her? No, you've had five husbands, and the one you're with now is not your husband. And there's some issues with what do we call that, serial husbandry, perhaps. But I don't think that's the issue here. Not dealing with polygamy. You don't like that term, serial husbandry? I'll just make that up. All right, you like that? So what is the issue here? If you have an NIV text in front of you, they are not going to merely translate the text, they are going to interpret the text for you, and it's going to read, has been faithful to her husband. That's not what the text says, but it is an interpretation of the text. If you want to know what the original says, anybody care? It's three words. I won't read the text to you, but it's three words that mean one husband, wife. Or it could be one man, woman. It's exactly what it says. So, you're like, why can't we just read what the text says plainly? It's because it's not real clear what it says plainly, right? One man, woman, one husband, wife. That's what it says. Husband of one wife, or man of one, or woman of one husband. So, there are some who take a hard stance here, and they would say, this is a person, or this is a woman who has only been married exactly one time. That's a hard stance. There are others who take the stance of saying, what Paul is saying is, they were faithful to their husband. There is faithfulness insisted upon here. Now, how do we understand what is being discussed here? Well, I went back to Romans chapter 7, verses 2 through 3, and there's a discussion here that perhaps would help us a little bit. So here's what the text says in Romans 7, 2 through 3. It says, for a married woman is bound by law to her husband while he lives, But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of marriage. Accordingly, she will be called an adulteress if she lives with another man while her husband is alive. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law. And if she marries another man, she is not an adulteress. So, what's Paul saying? If the woman's husband dies, she is free. She can go get married. That's no big deal, right? No problem. And there are no age restrictions on that. Now, let me add to that, we're not going to get to it tonight, but what verse 14 in our text here in 1 Timothy says. Verse 14 says, I would have younger widows marry. Now, if Paul is truly saying you've only had one husband in your entire life, and yet you've got younger widows over here, and he's saying, but I want you to go get married again, what happens if they get widowed for a second time? Oh, sorry, you miss out. Now see, in my mind, that just doesn't work. It can't be what Paul is saying. He would then disqualify these women if they were widowed. Say their husband died after a year of marriage. They get married. They've been married faithfully for 30 years, and then their husband dies. Sorry, disqualified. You've had two husbands in your life. This becomes an issue. Now, I don't think it means just being married one time. But what's not addressed here, and what more debate is that circles around, is the issue of divorce. How does Scripture understand divorce? If somebody is divorced, but their husband is still alive, is that still their husband, whether they have paperwork or not? That's always the tricky thing, which the text, of course, doesn't deal with here. What Paul's talking about, though, is faithfulness. There needs to be faithfulness to their husband. So let's just think in that aspect right now. Why do you think Paul brings up this issue of faithfulness in marriage as being a criteria for the church to step in and help? Or did I just completely lose you in the whole... Marriage is sacred. Marriage is important. Okay? It's God ordained, not just, state ordained. We should honor marriage. All right, why else? Okay. So character matters, and how we act in our marriage truly does matter. And I would venture to say who you are probably in front of your spouse is genuinely who you are. Anybody disagree with that? I mean, sometimes we get so comfortable with one another that our true colors shine through. And hopefully there's no distinction. But sometimes there could be, right? Faithfulness to spouse. Anybody else? Why do you think Paul brings up this issue? Because it's important. We'll just leave it at that, okay? Because it's important. All right, well, that's really one of the more controversial phrases in this text, because it's controversial in other passages as well. When you talk about the husband of one wife, what do you do with people who have had more than one spouse? And of course, the church has to be careful on this. I've told you my position before. I will state it again. With the ambiguity that exists here. Now, in a perfect world, I wish we didn't have to deal with this issue. And divorce was never an issue. You don't have to deal with it in the church. But in a perfect world, or in the world we live in, where there is a little bit of ambiguity, I do think we should err on the side of grace rather than legalism, right? And I do think, now, I don't think it's just a free-for-all. Divorce does matter, and the church ought to take that into consideration, especially was it pre-salvation or was it after? I mean, I think that's an important distinction, but there's going to have to be a little bit of grace in there. That's my particular position. Anybody feel like they need to take a jab at that? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Right. Depends on what church you're in, I guess. My experience in what I've seen in the practices of this church is that the position that I'm espousing here seems to be the position of the church as a whole, to really go to the side of grace, understanding that this is by far not the only criteria that we use for anything in the church. There's so much more that goes into that. Again, I wish we lived in a world where that just wasn't an issue, but we certainly don't. So, right. So an important issue. What we know is Scripture takes marriage very seriously. So if you're married at this very moment, let's take it very seriously and be faithful to one another. All right? So let me go ahead and say this. I'm going to say it at the end, but I want to say it now. So, yeah, there you go. You can point to one another. I want to make it clear as we think about this, we're talking about widows, and most of us are probably thinking, this doesn't apply to me. Hey, listen, if it applies to widows, it certainly applies to all of us, all right? These are critical character qualities of followers of Jesus, all right? If the qualities matter for widows, they matter for the rest of us, no matter what our age, no matter what our marital status is, all right? So I want us to keep that in mind. Well, he definitely held elders and deacons to the same standard, didn't he? But yet, you don't have anything there for other, or just men in general. But we're not talking about necessarily about just women in general either here. So I think there was that expectation. Yes, I definitely think there was. And I'll tell you, there could be something unique about this group of women. I'll explain it in just a second. When we get to verse 10 and we continue to look at the criteria here, Paul says they must have a reputation for good works. Now, some people think that you see that after the colon there, there's kind of a list of things, and there are some people who think this is describing not just widows in general, like widows the church ought to take care of, but an order of widows. And so you have elders in the church, and you have deacons in the church, and then you have this order of widows in the church. Like it's a separate group of people who have a specific function in the life of the church. In the early church, to be honest, now not like New Testament church, but within a couple hundred years, you do see this in the church. You see this so-called order of widows. And now what their functions were exactly, I don't know. I don't know exactly. But there are some people who think that is the case. Whether it's true or not, whether Paul is talking about a specific order of widows, what he is saying is these widows or anyone else, they ought to have a reputation for good works. So what does that look like? Well, this first one certainly gets a little muddy, doesn't it? In verse 10, he says, she has brought up children. She has brought up children, right? So we might expect the opposite here, right? A widow who has brought up children, we might think, well, that shouldn't be part of the criteria, because if she has children, those children ought to be taken care of her, right? I mean, that's what we've already seen in the text, but this statement, though, is added for a particular reason, and I think the reason is simply this. It references part of the ideal for biblical womanhood in Scripture. Not that every woman is going to be able to. We know that was far from reality in the first century or the 21st century. Far from reality that every woman was going to be able to have children. That's not the point. It's just kind of characteristic of the biblical ideal of womanhood. And so I think maybe 14 helps spell that out a little bit for us, where Paul says, I would have these younger women or younger widows marry, right? So marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. So if you want to look at first century womanhood and say, what was the ideal? It was marry, bear children, manage their households. Now, of course, not every woman did marry. Not every woman did have children. But this is kind of like the ideal of biblical womanhood that you see in Scripture. So what Paul is really saying there in verse 10 is, this is a woman seeking to be very biblical in the way that she manages her family and her household. Does that make sense? It just seems randomly thrown in there, but I think there's more to it than that. All right? After you see that, she's brought up children. Next, it says, she has shown hospitality. Hospitality. Why, or what is so important about hospitality in the church or in these widows? What's so important about that? Oh, yeah, okay. So if they've never showed hospitality in their life, why would they want somebody to be hospitable to them, right? Show hospitality to them. So is this just for widows? Right. Absolutely. Right, right. Well, we'll talk about that one in a minute also, but yeah, I think it is important for us to look at it that way. If we're truly talking about an order of widows, all right, Paul is setting some criteria here. But just like when we talked about elders, and just like when we talked about deacons, it doesn't mean that if you're not an elder and you're not a deacon, that none of that stuff applies to you. Or we shouldn't be striving for these same standards of holiness in our lives. Or if you're not a widow, this doesn't apply to you. You see something about the character of God and what it means to be a person of holiness throughout, whether you're a widow or not. So definitely a good point. All right, so has shown hospitality. Now, I want us to consider this. We'll kind of camp out here for just a moment. In Romans chapter 12, verse 13, you can put that up there if you want. You see one of the marks of any true Christian, right? And in the text, it says any true Christian, widow or not, it says they seek to show hospitality, right? So, as Cindy just said, this expands beyond being a mere widow. So, what does hospitality look like for a Christian? Well, let's think about this. I'll ask that question maybe again here in a moment. One person, Pat Enos, wrote this. I came across it the other day. She said, when hospitality is described in the scriptures, there are zero instructions regarding home decor, menu, or table settings. If hospitality merely amounts to having someone in our home and feeding them a meal, we've missed the bulk of what hospitality is, right? So, what are we talking about here? What does it look like? Maybe this will help, and I hope I don't lose you in some details here. But hospitality is an interesting word. And this word in Romans 12:13 is actually a different word. In English, it's the same. But it's a different word than in our text in 1 Timothy. I'll show them both to you. But in Romans 12, the word is a compound word. And I'll spare you the Greek with this. But the first word means love. It's that I'll give you one. Philo, right? Or it means brotherly love, right? So there's love, brotherly love, combined with the word for outsider. Let me go ahead and give you the word. The word is xenos, right? Anybody ever heard of the word like xenophobia? Xenophobia means fear of outsiders. When we lived in China, it was often called a xenophobic country. You know, they're afraid of other people coming in. People talk about America being xenophobic today. We don't want immigrants. We don't want outsiders coming in. They'll ruin our way of life. Xenos means outsider. So you've got two words, love and outsider, right? The stranger or the outsider, okay? So that's what we have here in Romans chapter 12. What about the word in our text back in verse 10 here in 1 Timothy chapter 5? Well, it starts out with the word xenos, outsider, stranger, and then it combines the word dokeisin, which means welcome or consider. So you've got stranger or outsider and considerate, welcoming toward them. So basically what hospitality is, at least based on these two compound words, is it is loving and welcoming the stranger among us, the outsider among us, the person who is not like us, who is not from here, did not grow up with us. They're different than we are, yet we're to be loving and welcoming toward them. So let me go back to that question I asked a moment ago. What does hospitality look like for the Christian? It's not the way we set our table or feeding a meal. That might be part of it, but based on the two words we just looked at, what is hospitality for the Christian? Practically. It's a little harder now, isn't it? So we have to be concerned for people outside our sphere of friends or people we're related to. All right, what else? You were saying something? Oh, dining with dignity. Yeah, honestly, that came to mind as I was thinking about it. Hospitality to the stranger, to the outsider, the person who might make us a little... Okay. You're one of a kind, Simon. One of a kind, buddy. Okay. Yeah. So hospitality means getting out of your comfort zone. What else does it look like for the Christian? Caring about others' needs, not just your own. Not being judgmental. We don't know the circumstances. We don't know what God's plans are for them. We don't know how he's going to use us in our hospitality to minister to them or be a part of that journey to Christ for them. Here's a question I really want us to think about. We don't have to answer this one out loud, but what does it say about our Christianity? What does it say about our faith if we have no outlet for hospitality in our life? Like, we're not practicing hospitality. It doesn't, again, now, we could talk about hospitality in terms of, don't everybody like invite me over to dinner this week and think I'm going to practice hospitality. That's not it. I'm not one of those strangers. I shouldn't be. Not an outsider. Not what the Bible's talking about. That's not what biblical hospitality is. It's going way out of, and so, for some of you, you may think, would be out of my comfort zone to invite you, Pastor, over for dinner. But, that's still not the point here. We would have to get out of our comfort zone to practice hospitality, to love the outsider, to welcome them. Right? Can anybody else think, what does that look like? Oh, I gotta move, don't I? We good with what we said? All right, good. We're gonna have to move on. In verse 10, after hospitality, you see, she has washed the feet of the saints. Now, was this literal or was this figurative? Who knows? Who knows? But what does it reveal about the person? That's the bigger issue. What does it reveal about the character of the person? And I can think of two words: humble servanthood. Willing to take the form of a servant. Now, it doesn't matter if it was a literal foot washing or if it was something synonymous with that today. Humbly serving other people. You could talk about dining with dignity. You could talk about meeting the needs. You could talk about mission trips. You could talk about serving in the life of the church. Whatever it is. Now, it does say the saints, right? We're talking about believers here. But washing the feet of the saints. There's humble servanthood in this lady. Also in verse 10, after that, you see she has cared for the afflicted. You know, I think it's really hard for most of us to care for the down and out, isn't it? Why do you think it's hard to care for the down and out, for the afflicted? Don't want to get our hands dirty. I'm in my good clothes. They're going to take advantage of me, okay? I really hope you're wrong, but you're probably not. We may not see hope for them, right? But we realize that all of us were hopeless cases until Christ didn't. Act like it doesn't happen. We don't like to realize or be reminded of how frail life is. Yeah. To care for the afflicted, it's going to take you out of your comfort zone. But this is not just true widowhood. This is true Christianity. This is true being a true follower of Jesus. So we're out of time for all my questions. But, you know, just think about this. What are some ways to actively strive for or toward this mentality of caring for the afflicted, being a caring person, kind of like we talked about this morning with Timothy? He's an outsider to those people, but yet he cared for them because Jesus would have, all right? And then the last thing that you see, it kind of sums everything up and goes back to what he said in verse 9. She has devoted herself to every good work. Now, does this mean she does everything in the church? No, it doesn't mean she did everything in the church. What it does mean is there's an eagerness to serve. Not just a reluctance to serve, but an eagerness to serve. And this is the kind of lady, this is the kind of Christian who doesn't assume somebody else is going to do it. Oh, this is where our churches falter. We just assume somebody else will do it. Right? Whatever the ministry is in the church, whatever the ministry is in the community, There's 100 and some odd of us here. Somebody else has got that. When is it my turn to got that? Right? We just assume somebody else will do it, right? So, as I said, we're discussing widows in the text, but these principles are transferable to every one of us. And so I hope we'll take that to heart. Look at that criteria. Manages the family well, shows hospitality, washes the feet of the saints. She's a humble servant, cares for the afflicted, devoted to every good work. Doesn't assume somebody else is going to do it. That person will take the initiative to do it. I'll tell you what, let's take just a couple minutes. What are a couple takeaways? What are some takeaways from this study that will make you a better disciple for Jesus? This is a very practical one, so this should be easy.